Hey, gang. Welcome back to this week's episode of Ranching Reboot. This week, we're back in the Eastus Media Studio in Pratt, Kansas. And today, not only am I joined by my good friend, Mr. Kurt Dale, I've got my lovely bride, Tanya, with me. And we're going to give it a shot and see how it goes with her pitching in and asking a few questions and helping drive the conversation. So, Kurt, welcome to Ranching Reboot.
Well, thank you. Good to be here, Mr. Brian. Well, easy on the mister with me, please, please.
You got it. Well, Kurt and I, we've been hanging out for the better part of the day, just kind of hanging out, drove around the ranch and looked at a few stuff. Yeah, looked at a few things, some stuff, looked at some cows, and now we made it up here. I really appreciate you taking the time out of your day to come up and sit down and do this podcast with me, Kurt.
You betcha. Glad to be here. I'm humbled that you asked me, actually. If you haven't, like, run out of people that will positively contribute.
No, I've been bugging him to have you since, like, before day one, probably.
Yeah, you've been on the list for a long time, Kurt. Well. Actually, you and Andy have both been on the list, but...
Well...
We're not going to make you feel bad for not bringing her today.
Well, she's teaching today.
She's a busy lady.
Yes, she is. Science fair is coming up, so there's no shortage of conversation at the supper table, so that's nice.
Awesome. So, Kurt.
Yes.
I know what you do for a living. We're neighbors. So why don't you tell our listeners a little bit about Dale Family Farms?
Let's see. Where do I start? I'm married to a lovely woman named Andy Dale. We've been, in September, we'll be married 25 years. We've got three girls. I've got a junior in college, a junior in high school, and an eighth grader. My parents both turned 92 this year, and in June, they will celebrate wedding anniversary number 70.
That's wow. Amazing.
That's mind-boggling.
It's awesome. It?
And they, what's even more impressive than that is they still live, I call it the home place where I grew up. They're still living independently on the farm. And I see them every day.
That's less than a mile from your house?
Yeah, about a mile and a half. Anyway, I grew up in Protection, Kansas. I'm an old Protection Panther. We're that's part of the South Central School District now. That's not what you asked. But anyway.
That's fine.
That's where I grew up. I went to Hutch JUCO, then on to K-State. I had a job for 3 years after I got out of K-State. I majored in ag econ degrees, what I got when I left K-State. And I thought I wanted to be a grain merchandiser, and I had a phone stuck to my ear for about 3 years. And
gross.
Seems like there's still times I've got a phone stuck to my ear, but it's anyway. One day I just decided I was ready to move back to the farm. You know, now I blink, 3 years goes by now, you know, in a blink of an eye. This is in my early 20s. I mean, looking back, those 3 years seem like they lasted 15, you know. I mean, it seemed like, but I, anyway, I moved back to the farm Christmas of 95.
Okay.
1996 was my first full year on the farm. And it was, and you know, Brian and I were talking earlier about how long Eel Farms have been in the family. There have been Dales in Comanche County for well over 100 years. My grandpa, you know, started, you know, a chunk of what we have now was started by my grandpa, and my dad, you know, carried that on. He moved back to the farm in the '50s after he and mom, you know, got married, moved back home.
Okay.
And, you know, and then, there are six kids in our family. I've got a twin brother, and he and I are the youngest of the six. I'm the only one on the farm. I won't for a second say that I'm the only one that was interested in the farm. My whole family, we've got a very close knit family, and, all my brothers and sisters very much, you know, love coming home and being, you know, part of the operation.
Okay.
I was the only one that showed an interest in the day-to-day, you know, being air quotes here, being a farmer.
Actually wanting to do the work of being a farmer and not just part of being on the farm.
Which is kind of funny you put it that way, because you know, where we're going with the conversation is a lot of that work I really got tired of. We were pretty conventional. You know, I don't want to say we were pretty conventional because my dad and my grandpa before him, they had a way of thinking about and doing things that looked like they were doing a lot of things that were conventional at the time, but they could make just about anything work. One of the things we do now is we say we like to do the best we can with, you know, what we have.
And
that's my dad and my grandpa before him did exactly that. You know, the tools that were available, they made shit work. Cow calf operation. Yeah, you know, we'd raise the feeders for a while, sell the calves in the spring. Alfalfa, you know, wheat, Milo, you know, the standard, you know, crops that are, you know, grow well in Comanche County is what we raised. You know, and then dad came up with an idea. He dreamed up a live bottom hay trailer, and we started, you know, we got a tub grinder. We started hauling chopped hay, you know, different places, and we had a pretty decent business, you know, side, I don't know if I call it a side hustle, but value added. Adding value to the hay crop by grinding it and hauling it. Then I also did some, you know, some custom work with that grinder. The problem is that works real, like a lot of things. Dad was able to make things work because he could fix about anything. The problem with running old worn out equipment is you have old worn out equipment.
And you have to work on it a lot.
Well, and eventually, no matter how much, you know, it needs to be replaced and you need to be more efficient. And so then you think, well, maybe I'll do custom work to help pick up that cost. And then the next thing you know, you're spending the time that you think you're saving by having better equipment, you're spending doing the custom work to help justify the cost of it. And that's where I was at when I was thinking about upgrading some of this equipment that was wearing out. And I, you know, we went ahead and replaced some of it, but in the back of my mind, I was like, there's got to be something better. And we, you know, cost of repairs kept going up. Fuel, surprise, surprise, never got cheaper. It kept going up, you know, as well. And Andy and I took a Dave Ramsey financial peace course.
Okay. Dave Ramsey is legit.
He is. We have probably strayed somewhat from the reservation. I like what Dallas likened that at the school that shall not be named to. Dad is like, use a tool, and if a certain tool hurts you really, really bad, you're going to hesitate to ever use that tool again. Anyway, that being said, we've restructured how we do a few things, but like a lot of things, the philosophies and the principles are sound.
Yes, for sure.
In a lot of different ways, taking care of small stuff and knocking that out of the way and then moving on to bigger stuff. Anyway, that course was instrumental in us really breaking down and talking to each other about the dollars and cents of the ranch and, you know, and what we wanted it to look like, what we were doing. And we're like, well, what can we do, you know, to, you know, add value to what we're doing to get more bang for the buck? And so that's when we started playing with the idea of direct marketing. And we started out.
About when was this?
Around 2005. We've been direct marketing for over 15 years, I suppose.
Okay.
16. Oh, good Lord, probably.
You guys are veterans, like, in the grand scheme of the COVID world with all this.
Yes.
Yeah.
We've We've learned a lot of shit that does not work, I can assure you of that.
And that's why you're here, right? Share all those things.
If we're going to need a lot more than 3 hours. If I just had a list and just didn't even go down any rabbit holes and still starts telling you stuff that didn't work.
Kurt's list of shit that don't work.
It's long. But I should say that is stuff that does not work for us.
That's a good point.
Because what we've done, we tried stuff because somebody else did it. By God, that's what works. We went and listened to, we marked a few animals to family first. And when that was a positive response, you know, we thought, well, we finished two animals on grass, let's try four. And so we...
Family didn't think it tasted like crap, you might know what you're doing.
Right. If the family and friends, if they like it, why, we'll proceed. When family was like, can we get like a half or a whole animal? We're like, okay, maybe we're onto something. And so then we did it with some friends. And then we went to listen to Joel Salatin speak in Oklahoma City. This was around, this was probably 06 or 07 when we listened to him. And that's when we decided we wanted to try poultry and, you know, pasture poultry. And the first year we did 20 or 25 birds, you know, for the year. So we just, the first time, a taste. And we built, a small, you know, the pen like what Salatin made, you know, we put it together. Well, I say we, my dad built it. We showed him a picture of it, and he's like, okay. And then he, you know, 2 weeks later, I mean, it was exactly what, you know, you see in his
books. That's cool.
Probably didn't measure anything.
It's a measure seven times, cut it once type of person. That my dad, I was not genetically stamped with that.
I wasn't either.
My grandpa was a craftsman. He could build it. You know, dad could build, you know, I can repair a lot of stuff. I don't know if I can build anything. I can build paddocks, but I can't build cabinets. But anyway.
So you had an awesome chicken tractor that your dad built for you.
Yes, okay. The Salatin. So the first year we used a Salatin, and it was pretty close to the house, and it was with not very many birds. We processed those birds, and to say
– I've heard this story from your wife.
Yes, say it was a shit show.
I've heard it from Andy.
That is toning the language down. Anyway.
Do we need to call Andy and have her come up?
No, this is probably like, this is another show with Andy here, and let her tell the story too.
She's going to listen to this, and she's probably going to be slapping me on the arm. But anyway.
Are you going to have to sleep on the couch for a while to tell this story?
No. Because it took a while to get it done. We'll just leave it at that. We
learned a lot, right?
We did. That was one of the list of things that don't work. Yeah, it's there's a lot of them that's involved that first chicken processing, and we didn't have much for equipment, and we didn't. There's a lot we didn't have then. My mother came down to show us, you know, the right way to do it, and
she probably knew how to do it from living through the Depression in the 30s.
Yes. That's exactly right. And process, and, you know, butchering their own chickens, you know, the old spent laying hens that, you know, growing up that they, you know, when they had the, you know, chickens there on the farm. Well, it took us 2 days to get all those birds done. For reference now, the two days to do the 25 birds. For okay. reference now, when we had Andy and I and two of our girls and one other person can help us, we can do over 100 birds in a little over 2 hours. So
it's just a small improvement in productivity there.
Yes.
Slightly improve that process.
Anyway, this is one of those rabbit holes I told you I get sidetracked.
That's fine.
Anyway, it tasted so good. We're like, okay, this tastes good enough there. We could dang sure tell a difference. And so, but we have to be more efficient. And so we decided the next year we would do more birds. Doing more birds meant we had to get further from the house. And when we got further from the house, then we started noticing that what works in Swope, Virginia for infrastructure, it's like a lot of things, the philosophies are the same, but the method and the infrastructure is pretty, you know, needs to fit the environment.
Right.
We were cooking those birds with their feathers on. I mean, the Salatin type pens. And so we went through several modifications to what we have now. What we have now works. We kind of have a day range system, and we have a pen that's heavy enough that it's too heavy to move by hand, but it's light enough you can pull it up with a four-wheeler or a ranger or something like that.
Oh, if that means it's heavy enough, it won't get blown away in our 80-mile-an-hour winds, too.
If the winds blow primarily north and south, I have had east-west winds that scoot the pen sideways. A 300 pounds angler iron dragging over the top of a chicken's, that's not a good combination.
Oh, no.
That's probably a wreck every time it happens.
I've never had a pin flip over. Actually, once, I don't know how this happened. It picked up the side of it, and it scooted it over, and then it came down. I mean, it's like it lifted it off the – I didn't lose any birds. The hell of it was the next morning – the birds were still, they were huddled up where the pen was, not trying to get in where it was now. They're like, dude, where's
my house?
Where's our shelter?
Where's my house?
Yeah.
So they're all huddled up in a pile where the shelter used to be.
Where it used to be. That's right.
Yeah. And so you don't put them, they free range during the day and they go in their pen at night, right?
That's right.
Okay.
They've bred the brains out of those birds, and we found that if you get them hardened up, they can handle getting out in the heat, you know, with small doses, as long as you have plenty of water for them to cool back off.
Yeah.
Another piece of that puzzle is those big white dogs we have. The Great Pyrenees, the guardian dogs we have, they roam a pretty good area, and they keep an eye on things, and they don't mess with the birds.
They have an alert system, an hourly alert system.
For the most part. There's times that system has failed.
Because, yes, there is.
predators are smart. We had a coyote that we figured out that the dogs slept during the day, and the coyote started showing up in the middle of the day to pick chickens off.
That sounds very, very familiar.
That's exactly what's happening. Just because nobody else knows. We have one of Kurt and Andy's dogs. We have chickens at home, and we have three chickens right now because Lily likes to sleep during the day. She's awesome at night. She patrols all night long.
How many chickens did we have 6 weeks ago?
30-some chickens.
Yeah.
And it's not, I mean, we've actually seen the coyote coming up into the yard in the middle of the afternoons while she's on the front porch, and she does. You were right when we talked about this. She sleeps during the day because she's up at night making sure nobody's in the yard.
Brian was telling me a little bit. He told me it was hysterical when that happened.
Let's not repeat that story. I'm not repeating that story on the air. I'm not telling that in a recorded medium.
About the coyote in the yard?
About what I did to Lily after I found the coyote in the yard.
Oh, I wasn't here that day, yeah.
No, we're not telling that story. Moving on. If anybody needs a great night watchman, get in touch with Tony or I, because we have one that needs a new job.
Because we don't have any chickens left. hijacked your story, Kurt. Sorry.
I know the genetics of that dog, and she has to be a smart dog.
She's very smart.
She's very trainable, too.
Yes.
Just not so good about being a day watchman.
You know, I found one of the most humbling things that one can do on any given day is try to outsmart any animal on the farm.
Yes, 100%.
Well, I think our smartest chickens are what's left. I mean, we've kind of had this conversation, like if I can get a few eggs from the hen and the two roosters that are left and start over, I've got a good flock along with Lily because they hang out with her now. The chickens just follow her around in the yard now.
And they're, you know, it's going to be that hen is one that you raised from an egg or from a chick, from an egg from last year. So we've got some, you know, if we keep those chickens alive and get another set of eggs out of them and generate some more chickens next year, we'll have some pretty good genetically, you know, adapted chickens to our environment.
Maybe.
That's the theory anyway.
Well, I've had a lot of things that on paper look really good. So I wish you luck.
Everything looks good on paper. Like I can make almost any enterprise work on paper, but in reality, it's always something else.
Roger that.
So, chickens. We were talking about chickens.
One of the side rabbit holes. Many of that will probably go down. Yes, we started the chicken enterprise. For reference, now we do. We'll probably put about 1,200 birds a year in a freezer now. We start more than that, but you know, you lose them in the brooder. That's a constant learning process, and you have to watch that. We get along much better, you know, with the pens than we used to. Predator loss, so on and so forth. Sometimes you have to have, you know, storms coming through is just part of it. If you do everything you can to protect those birds from the severe weather that come through, all of a sudden you're getting away from the, you know, pastured.
They're not having that stress.
You take a lot of the profitability away from it.
Well, in a lot of ways, you're stressed too. Like, we lose chickens, and the first, I think, 3 or 10 chickens I lost, it was pretty stressful. But after time goes on, you know, you start out with 300 of them, you're probably going to end up with 150 or 250 of them, and not 3 when you're done.
At the end of the year, if we've put 75% of what we started with in the freezer, we've had a good year.
I was going to ask the question.
Some years it's been less.
I wasn't, because I didn't want to make him say that ratio.
Well, I don't mean for him, but I just don't know in general.
If you're starting feeder cattle and you had that percentage,
that would be bad.
Right. That's why I was asking, because I'm sure with sheep versus pigs versus chickens, it's really different. And, yes, you know, a tiny baby chick is not a huge investment.
No. Those Cornish crosses are not that bad.
Yeah. So.
Anyway, moving right along, the poultry was pretty good. That was a constant learning process, but it was like a lot of what we started doing, we take baby steps back to Dave Ramsey, and the steps would get bigger, you know, when we could economically justify the steps getting bigger. When we would try something, and it felt like we were trying to pound a rat. I'm all for adjusting something, but after you try 2 or 3 different things and it continually feels like you're trying to pound a round peg through a square hole, we're like, you know, let's scrap it. Let's move on to the next thing. It wasn't the poultry. We learned things and built on it. And it's, I feel like we've got it's a very worthwhile enterprise now. To maintain. Somewhere along the line there, we also decided to add some pigs. And we bought feeder pigs to start with. Then we dabbled with having a sow, and breeding sows. And, you know, as cool as it is to watch a sow build a nest and farrow out, you know, on her own, is pain in the ass trying to keep a boar around.
It's a big, dirty mess.
And then keep them separate. And so there's a couple of 2 or 3 different sources we have for buying healthy feeder pigs. And, you know, that buying feeder pigs right now is a better deal for us than trying to raise our own. And so we buy them and we get them started. We get them broke to hot wire, you know, in a confined pen. And then we somewhat relatively close to the house, when I say close to the house, I mean within 100 yards. It's close enough that, you know, where we've got running water and we can, you know, the feed trucks, you know, can get in to fill the pig feeders, et cetera. We do have we say things are pastured, but our pigs and our chickens, we do, you know, feed them a ration. The chickens have to have something in that stomach to help, you know, grind up, you know, the grit.
Right.
And you're talking about a single stomach. You're not talking about ruminants. But
I don't know if that's a rabbit hole you want to go down, but I think that's probably something that's kind of interesting that a lot of people don't know and have noticed a lot on labeling lately. When you go to a website where people are selling pastured animals or grass-fed animals, they're going to be sold as a grass-fed beef or a pastured pig or a pastured turkey or a pastured chicken. And I would imagine that the common man would assume that means they don't get fed a ration. So you guys want to like explain a little bit like real briefly why that is?
I would tend to agree with you that like the layperson, if they see pastured, that doesn't always mean what they think it means.
Yeah. And I mean, even to me, like, I know I've got to feed my chickens. There's plenty of bugs and food in my yard, but you still got to feed your critters.
Yeah. They need a little bit extra.
Yeah. I'm not saying that feeding ration is wrong.
And at the end, cattle were made. We our country has the resources. We can finish the cattle with what can be grown, what's growing.
You can. You have pivots.
Pivot.
You have a pivot. You can make it rain whenever you want.
Fair enough. Anyway, we also have to make money.
Yeah.
Back to the economics of it. Could I get my hogs fat like some people do only on forage? Possibly. But I would have them a long time.
And you'd probably have to have your own hogs that you've bred,
yes,
and developed to succeed under that management.
And seems like I've heard somewhere that you need to turn inventory a lot. And part of that's another one of the appeals of the poultry industry, that those chickens show up in 7.5 weeks, they're going in the freezer. And we got those pins.
You can turn that, 5-6 times a year? Well, weather dependent, of course.
If I wanted to do it all year long. During the growing season, each of my pins, I'll probably run about 3 different groups. You'll have 3 different batches through. I've got 3 pins, and I'll probably run 3 different batches through. As soon as one pin's done, I'm pulling it back around. And I've got another batch coming out of the halfway house. The halfway house is one of my old stock trailers. That's I wouldn't pull it, a mile down the road, but it works pretty good to put chicks on right after they come out of the brooder. But anyway, another rabbit hole there. The feeding the pigs, the same thing. It speeds up the process. So we're hanging the pigs on the rail at probably about 7 months on average, which is a little bit longer than I think the confinement, but quite a bit less than if
they're just eating your yard.
Right.
Your bacon tastes better than anything I can get in the store. So whatever you're doing, keep doing it.
We've done experiments with your bacon, Kurt. Have I ever told you about this?
No.
Maybe
you have, but I forgot. But I'm going to say no. I don't want to admit that I ever forget anything.
This was an interesting, unplanned experiment. We had bacon at home we were cooking breakfast, and I think I had 2 packages of your bacon, and then there was a package of some Smithsville bacon in the fridge, too, and I cooked all 3 packages. And we cooked one of yours and weighed it. It cooked one of the other ones, and they started out the same weight. And I think it was 3 times the difference. So by the time I finished cooking the bacon, the finished product that started out the same, your bacon weighed 3 times the amount the finished Smithville product weighed.
Well, that's pretty cool.
I thought it was pretty awesome.
And probably, how did it, looking at the fat, I mean, was there?
Well, I mean, I've definitely gotten different bacon from you guys where there's more or less fat content. I got ends last time, which I love, by the way. Like, some people don't like it, but I love the bacon ends because they're so good.
We cut them up into chunks and fry those. It's like,
it's so good.
I'm going to have to edit all that out.
So good.
I'm going to have to edit all that out so we get all your bacon pieces. Nobody else wants them.
So anyways, I don't know. Where were we going with that?
Your experiment, you weighed them.
We weighed
You're getting ready to talk about how much weight is lost.
Oh, he was asking about the fat content. So, I mean, it definitely makes a difference. But, usually when I get bacon from you, it's marbled. It's got some fat throughout it. There's not like one big chunk of fat on one end.
Right.
So when it's done cooking, it still looks like a piece of bacon. And there's just a lot more food left over.
Well, I thought you were going to bring up the experiment we did with ground beef. We cooked up, I think it was, I can't remember if it was some of theirs or some other grass-fed beef that we got, but we cooked up I think it was a 2.75 pound package that we'd got from the store, and it lost almost a pound. Like, it was over 0.8 that it lost. Like, it weighed out to less than 2 pounds from 2 3/4 after we cooked it.
So it's like,
it's not
60-40.
Exactly. It's supposed to be 80-20 is what it was supposed to be.
And then the grass fed that we bought, it was all 85-15, I think. And the grass fed that we cooked, that was 85-15, lost like 2 ounces off 2 pounds.
Well, I don't know. The bacon definitely, and at this point, when we did the experiment, you could go to the store and I could pay whatever you guys were charging for bacon, and I could buy bacon at the store for $3 a pound. And when it was done cooking, you figure it out pound by pound per ounce, and it was still way cheaper to buy your bacon with the end product and the value, but nobody ever sees that. Nobody ever understands the end value of the product.
A lot of people just look at the price tag.
They do. They do. We were taught to because of our Depression grandparents.
And there's a lot, like I was saying with beef and, you know, with your pork, in those commodity products that you're going to find in a fancy, shiny label at the store, it seems like there's just a heck of a lot of water that cooks out of that meat, whether we're talking about pork, beef, or chicken. As I know, some people have done the same experiment with chicken where they've gotten pastured poultry and cooked it and lost almost no weight versus grocery store chicken that loses, you know, 20-30% of weight. So, like, that really makes a difference, and people can't just look at that price tag and tell how much of food is actually there.
That's exactly right. Andy used to make that point, with our whole chickens, you know, on the price of it. People, you might get a little bit of sticker shock when you look at we used to say one chicken would feed us, our fam. Well, those days are long. we roast two of them now, and there's still hardly any leftovers. But it used to be, you could have the one, you know, the bigger chicken that might weigh, you know, 5 pounds, those big roasters. You eat the meat, you know, you prepare the thing, you roast it, and you eat the meat off of it to get your meal. And then you'd have enough left that you could, you know, cook that carcass down then, and you could pull the rest of that meat off and make, you know, enchiladas or something if you want to do that. And then you've got the broth where you combine the two, and maybe you make a big pot of chicken noodle soup that would, you know, get another two meals off. That's real Depression era type of stuff right there. You know, you stretch. So then you look at the price of that chicken then, but all of a sudden you've got, we'll just say, two meals out of it rather than the original one, and the value still looks better.
Right.
Looks much better. Back to the bacon. A friend of mine and I were having this discussion the other day. Bacon, out of all the cuts, and I'm not just us, but I think anywhere that anybody has, bacon is the one that if you get that wrong, that's what people are going to remember.
Yep.
If you got to get one thing right, it better be the bacon.
I agree. I've been trying to sell our friend Matt on your guys' bacon for a long time, and he still shops like a kid that was raised in the 70s and 80s, and he goes to the store and buys the cheapest things he can buy. And I cooked the bacon ends when he was here last time over the holidays, and he's like, go back to the store now. He's finally sold. He needed to taste the bacon perfectly done, perfectly right, and he was sold on it now.
Cool.
So
pigs.
Pigs.
So yes. Pigs. Then what, Kurt? What happened next?
We thought, well, okay, we've done chickens. Can't be too hard to do turkeys. Yeah, no.
What's the problem with turkeys, Kurt?
How much time do we have, Brian?
All the time in the world.
I'll put turkeys and sheep in the same category. We've also tried sheep.
I was going to ask that. Are turkeys like the sheep of birds?
They're just looking for a place to die.
Now, let me start with some of the positives on the turkeys. They are a wonderful animal to help train young kids on how to herd cattle, because about 15 or 20 turkeys, if you need them to go somewhere, the zigzag motion, you know, like you do back and forth behind a group of cattle, you know, steering them,
right.
those type of stuff. They drive just like cattle.
Interesting.
I mean, herding, I shouldn't say just like, but I mean, it was,
never heard that before. I've never heard anybody compared to trying to drive turkeys or herd turkeys, and it's like cattle.
We've got a picture of my oldest. I'm not sure how old she is at the time. The problem one of the problems we had with turkeys too is we thought, well, we day range the chickens, we could day range the turkeys. Yeah, no, they take off once they get if you day range them when they're too small, they disappear in the weeds. You know, and a bird of a hawk or something or an owl is going to pick them off.
They don't have enough brain to know to come back like a chicken does.
Or they'll just gather up in the weeds somewhere and let a coon eat them at night. So you have to keep them contained. So you grow them bigger before you start day ranging them. For a while I thought, well, hey, these are just staying with the chickens. Yeah, no, that didn't work. They did 1 year. And I think that was a fluke. That's not the rule. That was a fluke that happened with that group. The next year, you know, they took off and they ended up, there's a row of trees about a quarter mile from our house. And there was about 50 turkeys down there around this catalpa grove. I thought, oh shit. So we got them out of I took Allison with me, my oldest. And we got them kind of out of the trees and got them on the road and got them in one group. And I gave her pulled the rattle paddle out of the back of the pickup. I said, just keep heading them towards the house. And in about 10 minutes, she had them walked back up the road and in the yard where they needed to be.
That's awesome.
Yeah. So luckily they got back so they could,
I wish you'd videoed stuff like this.
Well, yeah. We got them home so they could shit all over our porch again that night. That's another thing that they would roost on her porch. Oh, that made me so mad.
Anyway, I bet they're worse than the chickens. They're probably huge.
So we decided, okay, but turkeys sell.
Yeah, and they're not cheap.
No.
I imagine if you have your turkeys timed to where you're harvesting in November, that's, you're getting a lot more of a premium than you are for anything else.
You know, it's funny you should mention that, Brian. We also thought, oh, people want, they'll pay for the fresh turkeys. And people say, yeah, we want a fresh. So we phrased it like, would you like, yeah, we want a fresh turkey. And so we thought, so we timed it. So we would, the first year we did turkeys, we timed it so we'd have the turkeys. Well, we started them way too soon. And these turkeys were huge.
And I think we got one of these turkeys.
Oh, the biggest one weighed 30 pounds. Dress.
Those are big turkeys.
Gosh.
Yeah. Well, let me tell you, what we were using at that time for our chickens, this is before we have our equipment now, we had a turkey fryer that we were putting our chickens in to scald.
Okay.
And so I thought, well, it's a turkey fryer. It makes sense that we could, scald, our turkeys.
Sure. Should be able to put a turkey in a turkey fryer, right?
You used to be in the Navy. I'm sure you're familiar with water displacement.
Yes. Go on.
A very large turkey put in a scalding pot. Only we put it in. I mean, all the water to scald it. All the water is supposed to scald it. Just put out came out.
Just put out the fire.
Yeah. Yeah, so we went to Plan B. We finally got these. I think we only had 15 turkeys that first year. We finally got them dressed.
That was a long day, though.
Oh God, it was. It was. But the same deal. That tasted so good. We thought, okay, we've got to figure out how to do this better. Actually, I think the year Allison brought them home might have been the next year or a year after that. But somewhere around year three or four of turkeys. We started using the electric netting, poultry netting, and that made a big difference. As much as I hate the phrase game changer, that's what it was. I had a system. I've used the old stock trailers for the turkeys to roost in.
Okay.
And then I could move it around, and I'd set that netting up, and I'd, you know, give them a run about every, and we'd move about once a, I'd like to say once a week. Sometimes a week had 14 days, but anyway, we would, we, when they ran out of.
Sometimes my daily moves are 3 days.
Yes. Anyway, they would get moved though on some kind of a basis. And that worked good. The last, we did not do any turkeys this year though. That is one of the enterprise. There's several reasons, but, Andy went back to the classroom several years ago, and that by all means is where she needs to be. But when we're processing the turkeys in the fall, oh, time out on this. Another thing, back to the people said, yeah, we want fresh. You know what they were doing with their fresh turkeys?
Putting them in the freezer.
Putting
them in the dang freezer.
And we're like, well, we could freeze them.
Not do 15 all in one day.
In November when it's 20 degrees. So we started changing our time. And you know what? When we did them about 5 weeks sooner, they weren't near as big. but anyway, the timing worked out. So when we needed to process turkeys, Andy was back in school. And so I thought, well, I can do them. Of course, over a couple of days, I can do, 15 or 20 turkeys by myself. Chickens aren't any problem, handling, getting them in the kill cone, et cetera, et cetera.
Because they're, 4 or 5 pound bird.
Yeah, a little bit more than that alive.
Okay.
The turkey, imagine picking up a feed sack and the feed sack's beating you with a set of wings trying to get away from you.
We had some big chicken. The first three chickens I butchered this year weighed like 20 pounds apiece. They were like ridiculous huge. And one person holding those chickens up with a kill cone that was too small was a bad deal. I can't even imagine what it was like with the turkey.
So I was handling these turkeys, and it was work. Usually like the last, I wouldn't do all of them. There'd usually be some that we'd do on a Friday or Saturday when I'd have some help. And we got all of them done. I had a little hiccup in the health department this year, and we decided that sometimes all you can do is all you can do, and there had to be some things that needed to not be done. And that was one of the enterprises that we decided to not do. But we carry whenever we had – 1 year, I think we put over – the most we did 1 year we put – oh, gosh, it was like 110 or 120 we put in the freezer.
And, wow.
And I think we had 4 or 5 – that we carried over. I mean, that we didn't sell by Christmas. And, the remaining that we had, we went ahead and cooked those ourselves. Or I think we probably had somebody buy one or two later on. We made them a deal on so we could move it. The problem also, you get that it's not like packages of meat that are square. Those things are round.
They're awkward.
They don't stack. It's hard to get them stacked up in the freezer.
Take a lot of space up for sure. Not something you want to hold over for a long time.
Right. And so anyway, I'll say we hit pause because Mrs. Dale might listen to this. If we can figure out the logistics of getting, of hiring the processing done, we may very well end. And I could tweak my infrastructure a little bit more. We may very well, bring turkeys back sometime. But
you bring up processing. I was going to ask about that. You haven't talked about help. Do you guys have help? Do you use help? Do you hire people at all? Or are all of these things that you guys have done been done with you and Andy and the kids and your family mostly?
We have some wonderful friends that help us out on processing day. The husband will come over and he'll help out with the killing. And then his wife will come over and help out, when we put them in the freezer. Whether we're putting the whole birds in or whether we're cutting up and, putting parts in the freezer. That's where the man hours really start stacking up.
Yeah.
And we've got, a lot of this stuff works really well right now because we've got, you know, two girls at home.
That was why I was going there, because I know that Allison's not at home. You guys have one less set of hands right now, and has that affected?
She left, but the youngest has stepped up and does a lot more. My youngest girl, all my daughters are good help.
Yeah.
I've had a number, we're getting off on another rabbit trail here.
Chase that rabbit.
I'm going to compliment my daughters. I've had a number of teenage boys help me over the years. Some of them have been awfully good hands. I would put my daughters up against any of them in the work department.
I would second that with your girls and our girl, and oftentimes girls in general.
Well, Allison and I could go out and move a group of cattle. We quit leading them with the caker, a long time ago. Her and I could go out and herd the group, and they stay paired up better if we're herding them rather than trying to lead them.
So if you call them with a feed wagon, those cows will run off and leaf that calf wherever he was.
And if we're taking our time and herding them, every little bit they're stopping and balling and making sure that calf's with them. And yep. It's when we're, especially if we're moving pairs, across the road. But Allison had a way, has, because, she helps me time to time when she comes home. And Anna is there too, my youngest. My middle girl, she has a lot of gifts. Handling livestock is not one of them. And so we found other places to utilize her.
That's fair. I don't think everybody has it in them to be a great stockman
Brian
or a
just said
patient
that last
stockman.
Night. He said last night to me, I don't think everybody's supposed to move cows.
No. Some people do anyway, but they probably should.
I agree with that also. That is very true.
My girls, you asked about the processing, and I got sidetracked talking about the help, but, and handling stock. And anyway, they do a tremendous job of helping, whether we're moving cattle or moving chickens or whatever. Those jobs, some of them are not their favorite. But I think it makes them I'm finding with my oldest that some of those nasty jobs that she did growing up, like cleaning out the brooder or stock trailer, they truly do build character, and they give you a reference point for
absolutely
what else there is to do.
Absolutely.
Processing day. We try to start early in the morning before it gets hot. We get them chilled. We get them on ice. I say we'll do groups for our setup. Killing and getting in the chill tank. Right around 100. We've done 100. One time we did 150. That was too many at one time. Somewhere between 100 and 120 is about the top side of what we can. Live birds that we can for our how we're set up right now. What we can do. And then usually we get those chilling, on water. And then in the afternoon, then we'll either, we'll package them up, get them in the freezer, or we go ahead and get them cut up, and get the parts, vacuum sealed, labeled, et cetera, et cetera. And then in the walk-in freezers. So we have, it takes.
And that's just poultry you're processing on site, right?
Yes. Yes. If we're under a federal exemption where we can process, if it's got feathers under up to a certain limit, we can process and sell, we can deliver. We're under federal exemption. There's a state exemption. If you're under that, they have to pick it up on the farm. I don't know why it all works the way it does.
Rules. Food police.
Yeah, food police.
But it does. And so we try to dot our I's and cross the T's the best we can. Processing, we get that's the normal processing day. And then we back-to-back days suck. So we usually do a group on Monday, we try to not turn around and do another group on Tuesday. We try to maybe wait and do it on Wednesday. And I can see where, you know, especially cutting that many birds up. Andy, she goes fast cutting those things up. She is scary fast with a very sharp knife. But
stay out of her way. Mental note.
But I can also see where carpal tunnel, because, you know,
it's hard work. It's super hard work cutting a chicken up is.
Consistently, yes. I've tried it. She cut her, I think she has only cut her thumb once. And then I started, you know, it was a couple years ago. We had a lot of them to do that day. And after I did like three of them, she's like, move over. She wrapped her thumb up and worked with like one hand, I think.
You're too slow, honey. Sorry.
I was terribly slow.
When you know how to do something and you've got the muscle memory, it doesn't really matter whether your thumb's bleeding or not. You just put a glove on and go,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. No, for the record, she did not bleed all over product.
That's good. That's good.
Those birds are all gone by now anyway.
So. Everybody's fine.
So we've talked about your chickens.
Yes.
We've talked about the turkey experiment.
Yes.
We've talked about pigs.
Yes.
We haven't even talked about sheep, goats, or cows.
We'll have goats as long as my daughters have a 4-H project, and that is about as many goats as I care to have. We can keep goats in when they are on the smoker or in the freezer. Sheep are a close second place. Sheep are one of those things I thought, on paper, and I even penciled out, you know, we're going to start with this many, we'll keep this many, you know, we're going to, you know, inch it up. The hell of it is, it takes as long to take care of 30 as it does 530. I mean, there's, if one does something, they're all, well, I probably, and it's like a lot of things, it goes back to management. I thought, and like also a lot of things, you can read all you want, but the real learning doesn't start until you get the critter on the place.
Right.
And that goes back to being humbled. And nothing worked out like it's supposed to. I mean, they're supposed to be getting shocked and be terrified of that net. They're not supposed to be running through it and tracking it all over. They're supposed to be doing this and this.
The book says when you hit that, it's going to hurt. Why are you running through it? Didn't you read the book?
We had them around for about 2 years. And I decided that, well, and also, it, you, you know, in retrospect, like if I still had them, we would direct market a small percentage of them, because the amount of meat that you get from the live weight of a lamb carcass is really pretty low. I mean, it's like about 25% of the live weight. And so then you look at an almost 300-pound lamb's bringing, or almost 100-pound lamb's bringing almost $300, you know, live weight. And then you figure what, you know, you'd have to pay for processing, get them to the processor, and then what that, you know, pencils out to on a per pound price. And then you're comparing that to, then you look at that per pound price. And now it's not necessarily apples to apples, but it's back to the, you know, the sticker shock. You look at a pound of ground beef versus a pound of ground lamb, and, a tiny little package of lamb chops compared to a ribeye steak.
Right.
And the money you'd need to make it worth your time to handle that, it was going to be a hard sell. I mean, I love, as far as eating it, you know, properly prepared lamb chop is very pleasing to the palate, I think. My daughter makes fun of me because she's heard this speech a lot of times. Anyway, and we weren't moving as much lamb as we thought we.
You were trying to sell it processed, like you were trying to sell cuts, or were you trying to sell a carcass?
We thought we'd be able to sell cuts. We thought we'd be able. It was. We thought, you know, this is something enough different. You know, certain places we'd really be able to move the cuts.
Can I, before you go on, when did you guys have, what year were you guys doing sheep in it, or around about anyways?
I think it was about 5 years ago, four or 5 years ago. We got the first
16, 15, 16, 17, something like that.
I'll tell you when it was. I remember this because this was I stopped to watch my daughter play softball her senior year. Okay. I went to get these sheep, and I was going to watch her softball game on the way home from getting the sheep. And I was supposed to watch a doubleheader. Well, I had pickup problems, and I can only drive my pickup about 50 mile an hour on the way home from getting the sheep. And I ended up having to leave the pickup, and another guy let me use his pickup to go on home, and I stopped. So that would have been 2009. That was 18. It's 3 years ago.
Okay.
Is that – no, it's 2019. So it's 3 or 4 years ago, I think. So it seems like a lot longer. But
COVID has changed the way a lot of things work in general, like as far as marketing goes. That's why I was asking, because I think probably even now sheep would maybe look different than they would have 2 or 3 years ago. But everything looked different in 18 than it does in 22.
Oh, we used to be able to also, if we ended up with something, an extra animal or something, we'd call the processor and say, hey, can you fit – if I bring extra animal.
Bring seven instead of five. Can you do an extra? Yeah, there's none of that now, I bet.
Yeah, that's probably going to be a no today.
Yeah, it's probably going to be a no today.
Forever.
A year from now.
Right.
Yeah, it's that's another discussion we just about touched on. Anyway, processing dates, being able to just call up and get something in a hurry, is that doesn't happen anymore.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah, I just sorted off 12 yesterday that I found a buyer for, and somebody was asking me yesterday, well, why don't you just throw one in the grinder? Like, okay, find somewhere for me to take one on 5 days notice. Like, that's just not going to happen.
Yeah.
No, you'd probably just as soon build your own processing plant, to be completely honest at this point.
They have this thing called a plant in a box processing. I can't remember who's putting it out. They're not cheap.
Sounds pretty cool. I don't know. I have guys out in Colorado that are like, I can cut an elk up. I'll come out and cut your cow up on your
plate.
String it up with a bale feeder.
Well, that's what they do with elk.
A bale bed.
We've processed. We've done like a little party deal. We've processed a hog on the farm when we cooked it. And if it stays on the farm, or if you sell a live animal to somebody and they buy that live animal, sure, they can go ahead and do that on the farm. Yeah. But you can't. Selling those cuts.
Right.
I don't know whether it's right or wrong, but right now that's the law of the land.
Yeah, so, for sure.
We can do it, but it's okay to do birds.
Yeah, I didn't even think about going down that path. Why can't you do a bird just because it's smaller than a cow? I don't know, but.
There's probably a reason. I don't know if there's a good reason.
There's definitely no good reason. There's no good reason for any of it.
Now, I will also say this. Handling the birds is much easier than handling a beef carcass.
And the waste from it.
And that may very well be a big part of it, too.
So. Well, you don't have to be a very big person to manhandle around a six-pound chicken, but you got to be a big guy to manhandle around a beef carcass.
Even a
quarter.
Small one. Yes, even a small one. So...
Yeah. So, sheep. Are we doing sheep anymore, or is that?
No. I sold some of the bred ewes. At least I assume they were bred, and then sold the feeder lambs a year ago in December. And so we don't have the sheep anymore, but we do still have three very large livestock guardian dogs. Two of which the girls raised from when they were very, very, very small, and so. Three dogs, guardian dogs, is too many. But
they're a little underemployed.
Well, they make good pets, too, and they're cute.
Well, they grow out of being cute. they're good dogs. So they probably chase cars. If my neighbors are listening to that, they would disagree when they chase the cars like crazy. But anyway, they I can't imagine. The three are going to be here. They'll die on the place.
Yeah, yeah.
And which is right.
Yeah.
They're pretty easy keepers anyway, I imagine.
Well, you could feed a potload of cattle cheaper than you can feed these three big dogs.
Well, yeah, they aren't cheap. They aren't cheap to feed, but they are easy. They are easy to – I mean, I've had dogs, had a lot of dogs, and she drags crap around and she eats a lot of food, but she's not – But like Brian said, she's really trainable and she's smart.
She's an easy keeper. She just jump eats on a lot.
You know what? this is back to them being smart too. First few times I saw this with these guardian dogs, I thought that daggum things. They had, and I think you and I, Tony, have talked about this. They've had a dead animal, and I thought, well, they've killed a chicken.
Yeah, I'll tell the story if you want to hear it.
And I think you go ahead. I think the dogs, I think they dispose of, if one of their, what they're guarding disappears or dies, I think they dispose of what's left so it does not attract another varmint.
I agree completely. I've heard it from another sheep person before I ever met you or had the dogs. I'd heard wind of it before. So what happened with us is we'd been losing some animals, and I came outside one morning and Lily's laying in the front yard chewing on a chicken, obviously dead chicken. And I was like, well, why, you can't eat the chicken. This is your job. You're supposed to guard the chickens. What the hell? So I yelled at her. You know, I did. I was like, I yelled at her. I got onto her. I took the chicken and I hauled it off. And I was so upset because I was worried. I mean, I was going to have to get rid of her. Like, she's eating my chickens. What am I going to do? And I did. I called Kurt, or I text Kurt, and I was like, Lily's eating the chickens. What are we going to do? You know? And he said, well, are you sure she's eating the chickens? And I said, well, yeah, she was eating chickens. He said, are you sure the chicken wasn't dead already? And I thought, well, no, surely the chicken wasn't dead already. So the next day, we end up having a chicken come out of the coop, and it was injured when it came out of the coop. And the chicken needed to be put down. I'd gone out in my robe and let the animals out. The chicken came out, and it was kind of going around in circles in the yard. I needed to go inside and put some shoes on and get dressed so that I could take care of the chicken. And when I come back out, the chicken's nowhere to be found. I look all over the yard. The chicken is nowhere. I go back out a couple hours later, and Lily has the chicken in the front yard. But it had been mutilated and mauled at some point somehow. So over the course of the next several days, I watched her, and I sat out in the yard and watched her lay around in the middle of the yard with chickens. Our other dogs would chase the chickens and run through them. Chickens would run around, and she just laid there. Never once did she touch one of them. So what we kind of figured out or think happened is that there's definitely been a coyote, and probably we have some Mississippi kites, and we also have a couple owls that live where they come around during the day. We had the chicken that was hurt in the middle of the yard. It probably bird came down and got it, and Lily hauled it off and was chewing it up. And she's had some really good meals lately. I think she's chased the coyote off probably a couple times and got the chicken from him. But that's absolutely what she's doing, because she won't hurt him. She doesn't chase him. She doesn't play with him. She doesn't get after them ever. But as soon as there's one dead in the yard, she goes and gets it, and she hauls it away from the house or right up to the front yard. So it's either a long ways from the house or right in front of the yard where we can see her with it, and eats it and gets rid of it, and there's never any guts left.
Yep.
Is that what they're supposed to do?
Makes sense to me.
I think so. I think it's part of the 20,000 years of breeding that's in those animals. That,
you know, I mean, even like afterbirth and things like that, I would imagine that if there was a mess left, even with cows, to help keep that mess cleaned up would keep predators away.
I've seen some of those stories that, you know, that livestock guardian dogs, Pyrenees and Anatolians, will go up, like when they're with cows or when they're with sheep and goats, that they will go take care of the afterbirth and clean things up, you know, and watch the mother.
Yeah.
Now, you're probably going to have somebody that knows far more about guardian dogs chime in.
I'm sure I'll get tons of hate mail for it.
And let you know everything that I've said is probably wrong.
Wrong or not, it's what we've experienced. I've been really surprised, and I've been really surprised watching her from the time we got her. We put her in with the chickens at night, and they're not her people. We're her people. She stays on the front porch, and she watches us, but she knows those chickens are ours.
If there's not stock around, I think you're right. The dogs, then your plan B is, you know, the people that take care of them then are, you know, what they guard.
Yep, yeah.
I think that's why our dogs chase cars so bad, is that we keep our chickens run north of the road from where our house is. And I think the dogs recognize the road that runs in front of our house as part of what they're supposed to be guarding.
Yeah.
And every car that comes through there is a threat.
Yep.
Well, all night long, every time Lily hears a car, when she hears a car, because our house isn't too far from the road either, it stirs her up too.
You know, you could be standing right by those dogs. If you want them to do something or doing something you don't want to on a perfectly calm afternoon, and you yell at them at the top of your lungs, they'll act like they don't hear you. Mm-hmm. You could have a 30-mile-an-hour wind, and a coon could fart a half mile away.
Yep.
And they're barking.
It's been interesting because we have Aussies. We've had Aussies for a long time. Brian had a heeler when I met him, and I have a golden retriever. And in the past, I've had a husky. And having Lily has been much more akin to having Sam, to having the heeler, and to having the husky than it is to having the Aussies, because they have a much more stubborn work dog type demeanor, where my Aussies are happy, dopey, people pleasers. They're independent, and they're definitely their own creature, and they want to do their job, but they have their own mind for sure. It takes a different kind of owner. You have to be a stern leader with them.
And you have to be smarter than a dog, and I think that's my shortfall.
Well, I mean,
that's usually my shortfall.
Probably all of our shortfalls with a dog most of the time.
And with cows.
I understand that.
Yeah. Do you want to talk about your cows?
I love talking about cattle.
We've been here for an hour and haven't even talked about your cows yet.
We've hardly touched on them yet, have we? We got a cow-calf operation, and I do some custom grazing. Part of the cow-calf deal, we switched to a fall calving herd, and
are you all fall? Or do you have any, like, spring-summer calvers left?
I have spring and summer calvers when I buy something that might calve in the spring or summer.
But you're transitioning everything to fall.
I've transitioned to fall.
So not on purpose.
I fall on purpose, but if I'm from time to time, there are wonderful buying opportunities to buy something that's bred to calve, you know, in the spring, and then that works real well to you'll get that calf off of her, and then depending on, that's kind of like your coupon, and then you can, you know, that's a, if you know the ranch, you know, that female comes off of, you know, that works out real well, then to hang that animal on the rail.
Right.
Or you put her in I'll slip her into the fall calving herd. So there's some good buyback opportunities, you know, with the fall calving herd, I guess. So everything that I have right now that's on purpose is, you know, for the fall calving, yes. And and plus that fits my grazing the crop residues. I can have enough, you know, quality forage in front of them in terms of a fall seeded annual with, this goes back to the irrigation, I can make sure I've got the right quality groceries to have them, so I can have a good breed back, even turning the bull out in December.
Okay.
And also, I don't have 1,500-pound cows. I have, you've seen my cows, they're 1,000, 1,100 pounds probably, you know, on the top side.
Well, I know exactly what bull you picked to put on them this year.
Yeah. On one group of them, yes. That has worked real well for me. And we used to calve when I first moved back. We calved and started calving, I remember, the 19th of January. I don't know why that date sticks in my head, but it does.
Ouch.
I don't know.
And we did that for a couple. And I'm like,
it's cold in January. Like, do you know that?
But by God, that's what you do.
That's what you did. I mean, when I was even in high school, I remember that's what everybody did.
And so then I started moving it back to March, and I thought, well, that's a little bit better, but, you know, you're still. And then I went ahead and moved it back, and we started, you know, when we were calving in the spring, I wouldn't start until the middle of April. And that was just that for the spring calving herd, that's a good time. I mean, May, not too many calves will freeze to death in May. In our country.
Not very often.
I don't think I've ever seen even one freeze to death or even heard of one freezing to death in May.
Right.
Maybe in June, but not in May.
This May, you don't say that.
Yeah, no joke.
This could be the year. Now, anyway, so I moved back to spring. So that was me dabbling with doing things a little bit different. And that was, The moving to the fall calving actually had more to do with opportunities with the direct market. If I wasn't doing any of the direct marketing and I was just running, you know, cow calf, I would probably still be calving. The bulk of my calves would come in late April and May.
Makes sense.
The economics of hanging animals on the rail and, you know, when those animals, you know, turn up open at preg check. And that, you know, if they turn up, so we, you know, now maybe we preg check in April and May, that's right at the start of when our, you know, green groceries are showing up.
Right.
Those younger animals turn up open, they slide into the butcher beef deal, and I'm not wintering them before I put them in the butcher beef deal.
Right.
They've turned up in April, May, and so, you know, they're, you know, they just get.
Well, that makes sense.
They just, yeah. You know, they just get shifted into a different program. And, you know, everybody weans a calf or they, you know, find a different way to contribute, you know, dollars to the ranch in the bottom line.
That's a good way to look at it. And rather than everybody makes a calf or everybody gets on the Jesus bus, everybody gets a calf or everybody finds another way to contribute.
Yes. So anyway, that was part of the economics going to the fall calving herd. And then also then you know, if you try to maintain your numbers, then you want to buy back something that's bred, and, you know, some the guys that do like to calve in January, they have calves that freeze to death. And so if there's also opportunities, if you don't have enough home-raised animals, you could go buy a two-year-old heifer that just lost a calf and slide her into the butcher beef program too. You can usually get those bought, you know, pretty reasonable.
Or a lot cheaper than you can buy a steer a lot of times.
Or you could buy something that was bred out of sync for another ranch, and you could buy a heavy springer, you know, about that time, you know, and she might show up calving awfully early for your, you know, fall herd, and you'll but it ends up being a pretty good buy. So,
and you only have to push those, you know, those spring summer bred animals a couple of months down the fall rather than trying to get all the way through the dormant dry season on feed before you're trying to rebreed.
Correct. So anyway, that's one of the pieces of the puzzle there. Along with the cows, before we ever started direct marketing, a guy by the name of Lauren Graff used to be.
I remember Lauren.
Yeah.
He is a good hand. He helped me get set up, you know, with rotational grazing.
I remember Lauren when he worked with Ruth Timmons still.
Okay.
A long time ago.
We strung, you know, we ran some water line, and, you know, we're up to about 8 paddocks now. And
back in the 90s, that was a good place to be.
8 was better than 4. 4 is better than 2.
Right.
So I'm not sure what we have. I don't know that I could put a number on it now because we subdivide within the paddocks. And so the actual number of paddocks is kind of irrelevant. But
I know how that feels. Over 90 permanent paddocks, and like after that, it's just, it doesn't matter.
Well, I'm nowhere near that, but it's a different scale. But anyway,
I have to be 3 different herds. It's kind of like 3 different ranches. So,
yep. Anyway, so we started the rotation, and, you know, and then, you know, back to what I started talking about earlier, you know, with the equipment. When we started, as we moved into the direct marketing, I started unloading some of the farm equipment. You know, I used to do quite a bit of swathing and baling too. And so some of those acre, when I discovered when we were subdividing the big pastures, light bulb went off when I started realizing also when you started handling the cattle more, moving them, they started seeing you more than just when you're doing something to them. And all of a sudden, disposition wasn't, you know, we're a lot better now than we were then, but I started seeing improvements, you know, handling the cattle more regularly. And I started paying attention to guys like, I hate to mention too many names because I'll leave somebody out, but,
I know how that feels too.
Early on, anything that, you know, Walt Davis wrote, you know, I would, we made a trip to Hutchinson, visited Ken King. I tell you, talk about a gold Jayco Farms, a very gracious individual.
Super cool guy.
Yeah. He is so willing to share his knowledge, and his son's the same way. They're just
What's his son's name? Ben?
Daniel.
Daniel. I'm pretty sure Daniel's on my list to get on the podcast. I just haven't seen that particular list in a while, but yeah, Daniel King.
Yes.
Future guest on the Ranching Reboot podcast.
He would be a good one. Anyway, the late Terry Gompert, I listened to him. A neighbor and I went out to Colorado and listened to Ian Michelines. And let's just say I'm going to leave somebody. There's a lot of, a lot more people I pick brains now. But early on, you know, these were people who really kind of.
10 or 15 years ago, it was pretty slim pickings.
Yes. Anyway, so I thought, well, what if we start, grazing some of our farm ground? Besides, the first step was grazing the dormant alfalfa in the wintertime.
That's almost heretical.
Well, then I just put the hot wire around, a lot of it and just turn them out. And, I'd let them go for a while. Then end up, I was hauling feed to them, I was like, well, that didn't last near as long as I thought it should. And then that advanced into more paddocks and rotating them a little bit. And then after listening and reading some of Greg Judy's stuff, I really started getting into thinking about – I'm a thick-headed slow learner. I mean thick-headed. And I learn very, very slow. It takes me a long time.
I don't think that's true.
I don't either. Think
that's fair to say about yourself. And I don't know. Your wife might agree with that because she lives with you. But you figured some things out here that a lot of people aren't even considering yet.
I moved into the higher density grazing, and that really started opening my eyes up to what a number of different, You get a certain level. Brian, you said before, the magic starts to happen in the soil once you start getting above, 50,000, I think. You get up over 100,000.
I think I said 25,000 pounds an acre.
Maybe you did. You probably did. I'm not.
I'm pretty sure that's what I said because I was there when I said it.
That doesn't mean you remember
it. Well, when I tell the story, I say 50, but I'm going to have to, from now on, I'll say 25.
50,000 pounds an acre in our environment will drive things in a hurry.
Yes. My daily moves, maybe where I got the 50,000 is when I graze my winter stockpile, if I'm only moving once a day, I'm about 50,000.
I think that's about right.
I have found when I move twice a day and get up around 100,000, I could give them 20 or 30% less forage to get the same,
just by moving in one extra time.
Yes. Do I take that and go, however many more times a day? Well, maybe I could, but. There's also other things that I have to do, and it wasn't always practical to move them, twice a day. And then I ran into the dry weather and calves not staying in, and I needed to. But there was very little left on the stockpile I was on when I, ran into the fencing issues and moved the pairs off of that this year. And progressed into the much higher density grazing. And I don't do that all the time. I don't know if targeted is the right word. If it, there's in certain places, it's more practical.
I think there's a lot of words being floated around like targeted grazing or managed grazing that we're not all speaking the same language on.
Okay. Let me phrase it this way. It didn't always work for me to do it all the time in every place. Some places it works better than other places.
I think that's another one of those things that people make a lot of assumptions of. We talked about that when he was doing a lot of grazing with the Corianes to begin with, that people see you moving your cows every day or every 2 days, and they think you're doing that with every animal you have every day or in your whole place, and that's not feasible.
No.
Like, there's a time and there's a time of year where it works really well to move every day, and there's a time of year where you need to slow down so you have enough rest for the rest of your paddocks. And I'll say this, you know, I've talked a lot about Corianes and strip grays and in high stock density. I can't do that on the whole ranch. Like, you've ridden around it with me, Kurt. You know what's rough. Like, some of those canyons, you're just not going to, I'm not going to go down there with the polywire and come back up. I'm not going to do that four times a day. I'm just not that guy.
No, I would be impressed if you could.
Yeah, I'm not doing it though.
Now, when I use the phrase targeted, when I do the higher density grazing, it's on the acres that I'll get the most bang for my buck.
Right.
And where I'll get the most regrowth. That's usually on my crop ground, the better crop ground depending on what's going to be growing next, or if it's on my native range, it's on the sub-irrigated stuff that I know even in a dry year.
You're going to have some good production.
The production's going to be good, and if I don't get a lot of that production knocked down, it's not going to be, I'm not going to get near the value use out of it. And so I'll knock it down, and then I also get better regrowth.
Right.
And so that's and my country is nowhere near as rough as yours, but there are certain places that it's just easier to turn them in there and let them be there for 3 to 5 days. You'll lose your stock. And you also, you have to, you'll look at what you have going on. I have to do this on certain days. You know, I can stick them in this paddock and no doubt they'll have water.
Got to bring another set of 200 up to the pens, mm-hmm. and sort them and work the calves and work the cows. So,
or you have a basketball tournament, or you have track at state track. You have kids, you have a family life. And when you have the ability to make plans like it definitely works better, especially when you don't have help.
There's a lot of pieces. There's always a lot of moving parts. That's exactly right. So,
I think that's the nature of our business. It's like, sometimes I feel like a juggler, that you're just trying to juggle all of these moving parts and all of these projects that have their own schedule that can change with no notice.
Yes. And like a lot of moving, with a lot of moving parts, you have more opportunity for breakdown. And sometimes, you know, I remember working on equipment as a kid. We needed, you know, a certain tool to fix, you know, a certain piece of machinery to fix the piece of machinery that broke down. You spend half the day getting the machinery you need to fix the other machine. After a while, you're like, now what were we originally fixing?
Yep.
You know, sometimes life's like that, isn't it?
Yeah, I've done that more than once. Like, it starts as a simple job. Every simple job on the farm or ranch is one oops or one aw crap away from three more trips to town and two more things you got to fix in order to do one simple little job that should take 5 minutes.
Yeah, roger that.
I think they always say, like, every job is one broken bolt away from being a weekend, you know, an all weekend deal, kind of one of those things.
Yeah.
So sometimes I look at a can of worms on the ranch, it's like 4 o'clock on a Friday. I'm like, it'll wait till Monday.
Yep. That's exactly right.
Well, I think that's kind of a big part of the puzzle that doesn't get talked about in our world a lot, is the juggling of all pieces and how you do that, and whether or not you have the ability to look at that mess on Friday when you have a track meet to go to and say it'll wait till Monday, and to put it on the back burner and put your family and all of the things that may not seem like the top priority in the moment, but really are in the long run ahead of that rat's nest.
Yep. Yeah. And there are some things that have to be taken care of. Yeah. I mean, if you've got cattle out on the road,
that doesn't wait. Yeah,
you probably better not let that wait.
You don't get to go to a volleyball game instead of cows off the highway.
I don't know how many times I've, you know, turned around and, you know, put the work clothes back on, yep, and gathered cattle and, you know, fixed fence and then went to do whatever.
Yeah.
That's one of the, and some, it's sometimes that's not a management deal. That's just, you know, that's a deer knocking the fence down. That's
light. I mean, it's like, that's not having a 9-to-5 job.
Yeah. So,
I think that's part of your, you know, part of this part of working in ag in general. Your family gets to understand you can't be there for all of those things, and they appreciate it extra special when you are. And even when you aren't, sometimes they bring the flat version of you along when you can't make it.
Flat version doesn't eat near as much.
I bet the flat version of Kurt does not eat near as much.
Okay, so one of the two of you is going to have to tell our listeners what we're talking about when we're saying flat Kurt.
Flat Kurt.
Well, there's been two different times that I was supposed to go on a trip, and I haven't been able to. The first time, a couple years ago, was over Christmas break. Andy and the girls and I were going to go down to Oklahoma City and we spend a few days down there. And right about the time we were getting ready to leave, I had calves start getting sick. And I mean, it was, I don't know how many calves I was doctoring today. And I couldn't figure out what the problem was. But I was checking them two or three times a day. And it's not one of those things. If it's just a matter of putting a bale out, you know, you can ask the neighbor to come over and take care of the stock for a couple of days. But those type of things, I was not going to go 4 hours away and be able to relax.
Yeah.
And
I can understand that.
Luckily, my bride understood that as well. And the girls did too, to some extent. They're like, well, we still want you to go along. So they printed out a picture of me. It was not life size. I'm not going to, but
close it was, enough. But it's much. Awesome.
And they put it on a stick. And so they had flat Kurt that they carried along this picture
went
of me.
Ice skating with
on,
them.
That's the only way I'm going ice skating. Karen, damn
to you. It was the best thing. Like, our whole entire community got to watch Kurt, flat Kurt, go on this adventure with his family, and it was hilarious. It was great.
So that was the first step. Well, flat Kurt didn't get thrown away. He got stuck in a closet somewhere. And then this fall, we were all supposed to go to up to Manhattan to go to a K-State football game. And he had an Airbnb, you know, nice little deal set up, you know, close to the stadium, et cetera, et cetera. Our daughter's up there.
We're going to have to do that. Maybe we'll just ride along with you. So we have a daughter up there too now.
Oh, okay. I thought you meant you were going to take flat Kurt along somewhere.
Well, we'll take flat Kurt.
Well, I mean, we could take flat Kurt.
Well, anyway, we
might just get a flat Kurt and a flat Brian and send them around the world. Then you and I can just never leave the ranch and stay with our cows.
Well, I had some there's some medicine that I'm on that I had some complications with that resulted in a case of pancreatitis, and that was miserable. And so this was right before we were getting ready to go up there.
Oh,
and Andy and the girls were like, "Do you think you can still go along and just?" My diet for the next, you know, 3 or 4 days was going to consist of water and Jell-O. And I'm pretty sure – and no alcohol. And so I thought
– doesn't sound like a terribly fun K-State football weekend.
I couldn't picture myself I was finally starting to be able to get – comfortable and tolerate the pain, but I wasn't in a condition to travel anywhere. And I probably should have been in the hospital to start with, but I crawled in a pickup and delivered a set of hogs to the processor.
But you're stubborn instead. So you didn't go there, right?
Not at first. This is Dale main appointment and I stopped on the way home, but that's another subject. Anyway, that was Flat Kurt made that trip. So I stayed home.
Your family's awesome. I just think that's the coolest thing. It was really cool to see them do that and have fun and be able to include you even though you couldn't be there.
I have a slightly relatable story that I can tell that I don't think I've ever told.
Fire away.
So it was just over 20 years ago. I was in the Navy. And I was leaving on my first deployment for the very first time. And my mother was getting married. Remarried. And of course, I can't go to the wedding because I'm on this med cruise. So about 2 months into this med cruise is when the wedding was, and kind of similar to what they did for you, she printed out a life size, literal 6 foot tall version of me in black and white. And my cousin Mike took it upon himself that it was his job to make sure that Flat Brian was in all of the family pictures. So in all of the wedding pictures, somewhere I'm hiding in the background or in the back row as Flat Brian.
So, I didn't know this story.
Yeah.
I'm going to have to see some of these pictures.
Like I said, I didn't think I've ever told that story, and maybe not even in your presence. But yeah, you'll have to ask Mom for those pictures next time we're out there visiting.
Well, you mentioned my family. I tell people I married a much better person than my wife did. She used to disagree with me, but not anymore. She just says, yes, you did.
I'm on that bus. Like, I'll get a ticket on that bus with you, buddy.
Yeah.
On the bus that Andy's much better than he is?
No, that he married a wife much better than his wife married. I don't know how to say that. Wow. Let's move on, please. So what kind of cows do you have? We talked about it, but like.
Predominantly Angus. Okay. I'm not opposed to her. My youngest daughter, she has 4-H heifers. She loves Herefords. Growing up, we had Herefords, that's what my grandpa bought years and years ago. And we had those. And then Dad started crossbreeding in the 80s. Frame size like everybody else, way too big then. Then probably, back small. And
well, you probably started going back small before a lot of other people did.
Quite possibly. And small now for a lot of other people is, on the bigger side for me. So I guess that's a relative term.
Well, what are you calling small? Like you said, 9 to 11 is what you want a cow?
Yes.
I think that's a perfectly fine size for Red Hills range cow is 9 to 11.
It's a very doable size to get by on a given set of resources with minimal inputs and still produce a product that sells good in the commodity market.
So if your cows are around 11, 9 to 11, let's say, what are your steers on the rail?
I don't butcher a lot. We don't, on our butcher beef deal, we don't butcher a lot of our steers. It's primarily heifers, but we can still hang about 11 to 1200 pound animal on the rail. The steers that I have kept, when you keep them and you get, when they get just a little bit older, I can still hang a 12 or 1300 pound steer. The heifers.
Like around what? 24, 26 months.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Probably every bit of 26 months. Certainly less than 30, but probably right around 26, like you said, yes. When we were calving in April and May, they'd be 2-year-olds in May, and then you're hanging them on the rail in, June, July, August, somewhere in there, depending on what kind of groceries they're coming off of. So, yeah, about that 26 months, we're putting 1,300-pounders on the rail. So,
okay.
Anyway, I do like the butchering heifers, you take a calf off of them, or if they don't have a calf on them, a 2 to 3 year old animal that doesn't have a calf nursing on her, she gets fat in a hurry.
Yeah.
And
on probably not much feed.
Yes. Or the same set of resources that the cows are on in that time frame, they can explode. Yes. So that's what works for us. Anyway, Angus. We have dabbled with a few other things, but the Angus in the with the touch of Hereford is what works well for us, because size animal we have works good for the grass finishing, but it's also something that sells well. If we decide we don't want this set of animals, we won't take this set of these steer calves to the sale barn. They still sell good.
You won't get your throat torn out like I would.
No, we're marketing something that fits what the commodity buyers want. So, and that's what works for us. That's one of the lessons. You'll see a number of people that direct market and they want to raise this is type of heritage breed, whatever, blah blah blah. That's fine. If you can make that work for you and it tastes wonderful, have at it. But if it doesn't work for you and you have to sell it, you know, somewhere else, not everybody wants that animal. So you're either going to be hauling that thing a long ways or you're going to be selling it at a big discount. You know, if you have to market your what you don't want at a huge discount, you've just wiped out the premium you've made direct marketing. So
That's a good point. That's a good way to look at it.
For us, we try to make sure everything works in the commodity, even though we're adding value. Our backstop always has to be to make sure that it works on a commodity system, because that's the floor that's set.
I agree.
Because those are the tools you have right now,
yes.
Basically.
Yes.
Yeah. It's as much as we wish we could change the system, we can still use it to our advantage. We can still participate. You're constrained by it,
really,
yeah.
To a degree.
We can want to change the system, but we can't change economics.
Right.
So.
Yes.
And we can't change math.
Definitely cannot change math.
You know, one of my favorite things to cook on. Well, I've got, we start talking about cooking and cast iron and all that. We'd be here another 3 hours.
That's okay.
My brother gave me a Himalayan salt block a few years ago.
I have seen them.
And I use mine on the grill. You have to put it on right when you light the fire so that it heats up slowly, you know, with the fire. You can't put it on the real hot right away. It has to heat up slowly. But I'll scrape it off, and I'll just cook the meat right on that salt block. No seasoning. Sometimes I'll put just a little bit of olive oil on it, you know, to help sear it.
Okay, let me get the mental picture. So you have this big slab of salt.
It's looks like a cutting block. It's, you know, one – I forget – there's a lot more than just the two of you. Anyway, it's about basically 1 square foot.
Okay.
Is what we'll call it. And it's just, it's
like a tile, right?
Yes. And it's okay. About 3 inches thick.
Wow.
Probably 2.5 inches now because we've shaved some of it off. And you put the meat right on that salt block and just cook it right on that block.
In the grill.
On the grill, it sears on that because it gets hot, right? Yeah,
and what I'll do is I'll cook most of the time. Pork chops are my favorite to do on it.
Okay,
I'll cook them on there, and then right at the tail end, y'all might pull them off and finish them up right over the fire, you know, to kind of sear them, and then we'll take them in and chow down. And I've tried. We've got a good friend of the family that goes. Salmon fishing in Alaska every year, and he sends us some Alaskan salmon, and that is exceptional done on the salt block. So
I have to give that a try.
Yeah.
We cleaned some of our own bass out of our farm pond and a couple of catfish. Not so much.
did they taste like pond water?
They still tasted like pond water.
I think that's probably why I don't like fish, because I grew up eating some bass out of farm ponds.
No, I know that's why I don't. My mom told me she hated fish growing up. I hated fish because my dad fished all the time, and he would bring all these fish home and scale them all over the yard and then stink up the house with them. I never ate fish until I was pregnant. When I got pregnant with Krista, for some reason I wanted to eat fish, and then I started trying like ocean fish, and it's totally different.
We're strictly back to being just strictly sport fishers, catch and release at our pond. Yeah. So, anyway.
We've been here for like over an hour and 45 minutes. Can you believe that, Kurt?
I've wondered how we would fill the time, and I think we've hardly scratched the surface.
Yeah, of what I was going to say.
We could probably sit here another 3 hours if you could, but I don't think we can.
We spent like 2 hours riding around kind of talking about what we weren't going to talk about for the podcast, and we haven't talked about any of it.
We haven't talked about any of that yet, so.
Well, I was going to say, what have you not touched on that's really important to you that you want to
touched on? Oh, I told Brian, he complimented that I brought a folder in, but I haven't even opened the thing up and looked in it.
That's something I would do.
He's the only person that's brought a folder.
Well, it doesn't count if he doesn't use it.
Oh. But he brought one.
Are we just about done then?
We can keep going. We want to keep going.
Yeah.
No, like if there's something we kind of drove through your story.
Well, I told Brian there is one thing that I wanted to touch on. We'll see how I can do getting through this. A number of years ago, I discovered I discovered how important mental health is in agriculture. I shouldn't say I discovered it. I probably always knew it, and just didn't, you know, really put two and two together. But I wrote the years down because I forget. In 2013, my youngest daughter and I were in a wreck, in a pickup wreck. I probably should have died, but I didn't. A semi hit the broadside of us, and I had a severe concussion. But I walked home, went home from the hospital that night. About a little over a year after that, Andy and the girls and I sat in our car on a Sunday, and we watched our house burn to the ground.
That's rough.
There's better ways to spend a Sunday, I can assure you.
There sure are.
Well, yo, by God, you keep on going. Yo, you just hitch up your britches and you keep on going. In retrospect, that was probably a mistake. You know, probably, you know, you just shove stuff, you know, deep down inside, and you just keep on going because, by God, that's what you do.
Yeah.
And, oh, a few years ago, I found myself in a really, really dark place. And I think looking back, those two events, I think, changed something inside of me. As you might imagine. And I found myself in this really, really dark place. And luckily, this goes back to what I said earlier, I married a very, very good person. She knew I needed some help. And I spent some time talking to the good people at the Iroquois Center in Greensburg. And I started doing a few things, and I realized I suffer from I fight a little bit of depression, and I luckily mine is not you know, severe. I'm not on any medication. Not that there's anything, you know, wrong with that if that's what one needs, but I was able to just start. It made me very aware, though, that too often in agriculture we don't take time to take care of ourselves mentally. This back to what we were talking about, you know,
suck it up.
Going on, you know, we don't step back and just, it'll be there tomorrow. We don't, you know, reach out for help when we need it. And the thing is, in our country, we are surrounded by people that love to help people. That's probably one of our country's, rural America's biggest assets is people love. People don't like to admit that they need help themselves, but they'll go help other people in a heartbeat. And anyway,
That is one of the sad but unfortunate truths. If you ask somebody for help out here, very, very rarely will you get told no. I think it's because we just have that block in our heads against asking for help, that when we hear that request, it's such a novel thing. It's like, well, yeah, I'll do whatever I can to help you.
I wish everybody could, you know, after our house burned, that's one of the most humbling things, the support, you know, complete strangers, you know, people, you
know, changed my life,
you know, helping you out. I wish everybody could experience that without having to go through the shitty stuff,
yeah,
you know, to get to that point. But that's not how it works. But anyway, we made a few, when I was in this little, I call it the dark spot, dark place. Anyway, I crawled back up out of it with a lot of help. It's amazing when I call it the My House Burned to the Ground Club. There's a lot of people that are in that club that you don't know it. It's a club nobody wants to be in, but once you're in it, you're surrounded by a lot of good people. The depression was the same way. There's a number of people that reached out to me. I made something somewhat public and said that I you'll kind of, I fight this beast, and it is a beast. A number of people reached out and said, you know, I fight the same. And there's 3, 4, 5 guys that I talk to somewhat regularly that I know have fought the same beast. And
I've struggled with depression on and off my whole life.
I don't know if it's an accountability club, but there's something about
it's a vulnerability club. When you give the power of that anxiety, the stress, the depression, and the aloneness away, when you're not alone with it anymore, it doesn't have the same power because you're not sitting there wondering anymore, is everybody feeling this way? Am I alone feeling this way? Why am I feeling this way? Suddenly it's like, oh, wow, it's not just me. Everybody else has felt this. This is human, and this too shall pass. This is my emotions, and I'm stronger than this. And you've got to have people to remind you of that.
And I, you know, the doctor I was visited with, he said, you need to find something to do that's just you.
That's not work.
Well, it took me a while to get there, but I rediscovered how much I love fishing. And I've been fishing, and then my youngest daughter decided she likes to fish. She's a hell of a fisherman. She's my grandpa, you know, was a that's another story I want to tell before we're done. My grandpa was, you know, quite the fisherman too. But anyway, I've probably you know fished once or twice a year, you know, for the 10 or 15 years prior to this spring. This year, since spring, you know, if I didn't, once it warmed up, if I didn't fish once or twice a week, you know, it was, Ann and I were going down to the pond at least once a week, or we were going somewhere.
That's awesome. So, like as a mom, not your person or anything, but like that's a proud thing to be able to see, to be able to spend that time with your family. And
we'd go down there and we'd take the ranger down there and, everything just stopped. And there was one afternoon we went down there, and Anna says, we've been down here, what, about an hour? We'd been there for almost 5 hours.
Oh, wow.
I mean, the fish were biting. It was one of those,
having a great time.
Yeah. It's like, why is it getting dark at like 4 o'clock?
It's kind of warm and fuzzy for me to hear that. So my dad took me fishing. Actually, my dad took me fishing out at Brian's ranch years and years before I ever knew Brian or that Brian existed. And my dad didn't drink. So a lot of times you hear people fishing and drinking, you know, but my memories around fishing have always been me and my dad doing stuff together. And so it's kind of nice to hear you and doing fishing things with your girls and not just drinking fishing stories, I guess.
Nope. my grandpa, I mentioned, he came home from, he was in Europe in World War I. He came home from Europe, and this was before he married my grandma. He went to Canada. He spent this winter in Canada trapping with a Norwegian.
Oh, cool.
And, I mean, that's, you know, and then I think he just had one last.
Like a sabbatical winter for himself to go.
Probably just need to wind down after seeing God knows what over Europe.
Well, yeah, I bet so.
And, you know, anyway, then he came back to the farm and, you know, the rest was history. Well, then another deal, 1936, my dad was 6 years old and depression, dirty 30s, drought, all that. Nothing was growing. We didn't have any cattle at the time, but, you know, grandpa had a flock of sheep or herd of sheep, whichever it is, and hired some old guy. He traded out if he could stay in the house. You know, if he just took care of the sheep, and grandpa knew how much money he was going to, you know, if he was going to stay on the farm and try to farm, the banker said, well, I'll loan you X amount of money. My grandpa borrowed the money, but instead of farming, they bought a new car and they loaded up the family and they left. They drove up. They spent about 18 months. I don't know if it was over a year or not. Anyway, they just took off. They went up, you know, into, I think they somewhere close, you know, up through, you know, Jackson Hole, Wyoming, and then straight south, they saw the Grand Canyon, then eventually, you know, back to protection.
Oh, cool.
And, you know, back then, they just drove, and, you know, when they wanted to eat, they would just stop and camp, and then they'd fish, and they'd, you know, catch their food, and, you know, gas didn't cost, you know, hardly anything. And
3 cents a gallon.
Grandpa had a camera, and he filmed a lot of that trip. And a number of years ago, this is the same. I sent you a copy of the diary he kept when he was in Europe, too, I think.
Yeah, that was an amazing read, by the way. Thank you for sharing.
He logged, took all these pictures of that trip. So the diary I just mentioned, when my grandpa was in Europe, he kept a diary. And a few years, I mean, you can hardly read the writing. A few years ago, I had a cousin that transposed that and put it all, wrote it all out so it's actually readable. And then to enhance it even more, he went to Google Maps. He kind of looked at the towns where he'd been, and he kind of pieced together a map that would have been a path of where Grandpa was. He was in the band. He'd never played the clarinet till he was in the Army. But they said they're looking for volunteers to be in the band. And he told Dad in later years that he thought that was the safest way to go over. He knew he was going to go over there, but he thought he had the least chance of getting shot.
Smart guy.
Anyway.
Give me the choice, Tink. Yeah. I'd probably try to join the band, too, or the chorus.
He learned how to play the clarinet. So
that's interesting. So did they? So is the diary printed as a book now? Or
It's not really a book, but it's printed out. Each of us kids, the cousins all have it. And then I'd be happy to send you a copy of it if you wanted to.
That'd be really interesting. My dad would get a huge kick out of that, too, for sure.
It's fascinating.
Yeah, I bet so. That's awesome.
That's quite a rabbit trail we went down there. But I guess it's a piece of the puzzle of who I am today, I guess.
Hey,
it's all piece about the all pieces of the puzzle.
Anyway.
I appreciate you being as open and as vulnerable as you have been, because I know that's not easy to share, but every person that is able to share a little bit of a story like that, that somebody sharing their story helped you. And I know you know that, and it's just, it compounds. So every time you're able to do that.
Well, if I could help somebody with that story, if I could choose somebody to help somebody with that story, or help somebody with their grazing, I can assure you which story is
more important. Yeah. Is there anything after going through that experience and still dealing with that beast, because it doesn't just go away, that you would want to share that you feel like would have been helpful for you to know 5 or 6 years ago? That, I mean, in small communities, we don't talk about this. So how do we get people more willing to share?
Just know that there's more people out there that fight this beast than what you think. So, and honestly, everybody's got a story. An old guy that I always had a tremendous amount of respect for told me one time, he said, so you think you got it bad, just look around and then figure out who you want to trade places with. Chances are it'll be nobody. So then you just get your chin up, put your best foot forward, and keep on going. So
that's good advice.
Yep.
Very good advice.
Probably great advice. We've gone past 2 hours. You want to keep going? Are you ready to end and go down to Legends and get a burger?
I'm ready to go get a burger.
Okay. Well, we're going to go down to Legends and eat some of their wonderful food here in Pratt. My friend Cody Eastus is owner of that place. Same guy that lets me use this awesome studio to record this wonderful episode in. So, Kurt, have we forgotten anything you need to talk about?
I should probably mention if you're in need of meat.
Yeah.
Yes.
You should probably mention your website.
Yes.
DaleFamilyFarms.com.
Okay. What can we get at DaleFamilyFarms.com?
We offer grass-finished beef, variety, almost any cut of the animal. We have pork, and we also have poultry, chicken. You can get whole chicken or you can get chicken parts, either one.
And it's all fabulous. And our freezer is full of it. I can vouch for that.
We can sell individual cuts.
Our freezer is not full of their ground beef.
I talked to Andy yesterday.
Okay.
Oh,
okay.
Right, but you guys deliver too, don't you?
Yes, we do.
Do you ship?
No, we have dabbled with shipping. Right now, the logistics for us aren't that good.
Okay.
But you guys are a pretty big delivery circle.
Yeah. Well, circle isn't the shape that I would describe, but we go to the southwest part of the state. With Liberal up to Garden City and back, stops in between with some variation from time to time. And we do that once a month. And we call it a delivery trip to the east. There's, Larne, Great Bend, Hutchinson area down to Wichita and then back to Protection. And then once a quarter, we will go all the way to the Kansas City area. That works because I've got family up there. That one's a 2-day trip. We'll go and we'll hit spots in between here and there. And then people meet at my brother's driveway, and he always thinks that's cool that customers show up and he gets to visit with them and
gets to meet people.
They show up at the little complex there where they live, and then I head back and we make other stops on the way home. So
very cool.
The delivery does it works for anyway. The delivery trips work for us. We decided that if we move enough product, the cost of owning a van and the fuel is less than every now and then having to have stuff on sale at a big discount, and it ties in, it keeps the product moving, theoretically.
I can see that.
So we don't like to run sales because
I don't think I've ever seen you run a sale or offer a discount.
People often, and we're guilty of this too, you see something on sale, wait for it to go on sale.
Yep.
Well,
Something that I heard a really good piece of advice during this whole COVID thing, and it came from a small business owner and somebody who goes around and really makes it a point to spend their money at small businesses. A lot of local small businesses try really hard to offer those discounts, especially to their, longtime customers. And this opened my eyes. I want to use the discount at Walmart. I want to use the discount at Dillon's. I don't want to use the discount at Ace Hardware, and I don't want to use the discount at your store. I want to spend my money at your store and not spend the damn money at Walmart. So, I've made it a point to say, thanks for the discount card, but you can keep that. I'll spend my money here. And, it's Brian's itching to talk.
I think Mike Calicrate almost said that verbatim, like whatever that was, 34, 35, 30, whatever episode.
I know how much your product costs and I budget for it. That's all there is to it.
Well, we appreciate you for that.
That's just how you look at it.
Mike says that he wants to pay full price because he wants to know that the people that work there are getting paid fair wage for the labor that they're doing, and not, that company that's offering the discount card is not externalizing their cost and
externalizing. Like Dollar General does.
Yeah.
Right.
We've spent enough time yelling about Dollar General on this show.
Mike Calicrate spent enough time yelling about Dollar General for all of us.
Yeah, I won't go down that road either. No, we're not trying to sell to everybody.
Yeah.
And you know what? No matter how cheap if that was your target, if we said, we're selling everything for a dollar, there'll be somebody trying to talk you down to 50 cents.
That is an amazing, amazing, amazing piece of advice for any business owner, is that you're not going to be right for everybody. And if you try to please every customer, you're not going to please any of them.
And so what we try to offer is service and relationship. A number of people, our customers, we have some that have been with us close to the 15 years. We know their story, and we've had some we've delivered their house. We you give them a little extra special. And you know what? The Piggly Wiggly or Dylan's or whatever is not going to go in and help you fill your freezer, you know, et cetera, et cetera.
Or find, like, I mean, Andy's come through town before and hollered at me to drop stuff off at my store because somebody in Medicine Lodge needed to pick something up and wasn't around. And you guys will go out of your way to find that person in that place to make sure people can get their food.
If we need to.
Yeah, it's a huge deal.
Now, that being said, when we do deliveries and we're on a set schedule,
don't make them wait.
We sure appreciate if you're on time.
Yes, yes. It's been, I've not been here. Hey, thanks for letting me do this today, guys. Kurt, this is the first time I've really been on the podcast.
Did you know? You know what? Me too.
Well, it's not produced in your basement, though.
No, Brian's not going to say, that was a good practice. This one's for real.
Yeah, are you guys really ready to do it now? We've just been warming up for 2 hours. I'm about ready to actually hit the record button.
Ready, set, go.
Ready, set, go. No, yeah. Seriously, it's been great. Tanya, thank you for thanks for being here. Really appreciated you joining us for this episode, and we might have to do this again sometime.
Yeah, I was glad. I'm glad I got to be here and visit with you too, Kurt.
Always appreciate your insight.
Same with you.
Brian, thanks for having me. Once again, I'm humbled that you would think what I had to offer is worthwhile, so I appreciate that.
Kurt, I've always thought that what you've had to offer is worthwhile ever since I first met you.
Oh, well, you're very kind.
Thanks for being here. It's been a wonderful episode. It's been a great day. It was a great day to spend with you, and really appreciate you as a neighbor. And with that, we're going to go ahead and sign off, and we'll see you all next week.